Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. Today we're listening to Mumbrella's most recent Question Time Breakfast, which took place on November the 10th in Sydney. Speaking on the panel was Henry Tager from Media Brands, Telstra's Mark Collis, ACP's Deborah Thomas, and Trinity P3's Darren Woolley. In this second and final part, we discuss: are pitch consultants a barrier to agencies developing relationships with new clients? What's the next big thing on the horizon in 2011? What's the best path a producer should follow in order to pitch branded content? And best ads of the year. I saw one more hand over there, and then we'll go to back to moderated questions again. If you could tell us who you are and where you're from.
Hi, I'm Julia Varjou from New Business Methodology. This question was originally for Darren, but I'd love to hear the board's view. It's really about how an agency can develop a relationship with a client who's reviewing when there seem to be so many more pitches that are run by either pitch consultants or procurement departments. In a sense, it almost feels like there's a chaperone between you while you're trying to date. And as we know, many of the longest and most successful agency-client relationships that are the most famous have a very deep ingrained relationship. So I just wanted to get your perspective, Dan, but then the others, because you've all been involved in pitches as well as on either the client or the agency side.
Might as well start with you,
Dan. Okay. It was a point that was driven home earlier this week to me when a head of marketing services said, "We run lots of pitches ourselves and we choose the best idea." And I said, "Well, aren't you actually buying a relationship? Because ultimately when you appoint an agency, you're not just buying the idea they come up with in a pitch. In fact, that's the worst way of choosing an agency. You actually want to understand the people and how you work together, which is why we actually run a process where we have full-day workshops with the marketing team and the shortlisted agency. And both the agency and the marketers get a sense of test driving each other. And it's a great way of starting the relationship. Our role is not to be a chaperone, it's really to manage the process so everyone gets a fair go. And that there's not, the whole process is not skewed by, you know, inappropriate behaviour. So, having said that, I do know that there are a lot of people that still get in the way and basically try and filter the process, which is the worst thing you can do. You know, it is a long-term relationship, and so you need to do a process where people can really, you know, get to know each other and make decisions on that basis.
Deborah, I guess you've been a client at times as ACP.
Well, I'm going to think about, you know, I'm going to go back sort of probably 20 years ago where there were no chaperones, and I have to say they were the halcyon days where you could just pick up the phone and speak directly to the clients. I mean, obviously things have changed, and the chaperones that we see now, and all due respect, you know, are the media buyers that sort of we used to deal directly with clients. And we still can deal directly with clients, but obviously we're very, very sensitive to, you know, the fact that we're also working with media buyers. Now, I'm going to talk about this more from an editorial perspective, because one of the things that we get a lot of in magazines over my time has been clients coming directly to us, and I'll use David Tomlinson from MLA as one. He'll come to me as an editor and say, "This is what I want to do, what are your ideas?" So they're tapping in, they're smart. The smart people tap into the various people that they need in order to get the job done. So he'll come and talk to me about creative, and a lot of clients will come and talk to us, the editorial team, from a creative perspective, and that is obviously moderated by our advertising sales teams. And then we'll work with media buyers, and they'll work with media buyers as to how that message is taken to market, and more and more. I think from my perspective, and the only time that kind of it starts to drive me nuts, is if I get a media buyer who starts to dictate the creative. And there are a few of those around. I think that it's fine that they would have an understanding of the creative in behalf of the client. But I have no qualms. If I see an ad come through, and more often than not it's an advertorial, and I look at it and I think something's wrong, you know, call me strange, but I'll either pick up the phone to the media buyer, or I'll pick up the phone to the marketing director and tell them what I think. And in some cases, they've been changed, and I think for the better. And I think that having as much of an open relationship with all parties that you can is to the benefit of everybody.
Henry, I suppose that almost brings out two aspects. So the pitch consultant as chaperone and your own role as a chaperone as well.
Maybe I'll start with the pitching and procurement and pitch facilitators. I think a lot of agencies who are in pitches focus on the pitch consultants and try to win them over and try to play. They play the man on point who's going to be looking at the numbers. I think we've had the benefit of making the mistake of doing that as a group of agencies. What we've had success this year by not worrying about that and just focusing on what the real opportunity is and almost ignoring the consultants or the procurement teams, and with all due respect to them, because we can't control what they think, what they will evaluate, and we can't control what our competition will do either. All we can focus on is ensuring that we put the best solution forward to the marketing team, because in our view, they're ultimately responsible for the marketing and or the media, not the procurement or Darren's peers. So that's been our approach, and it has proven to be successful this year, so we're going to continue to do that. We're going to continue to annoy you, Darren. As for being the perceived chaperone to the media process, I think Deborah's right. We shouldn't be dictating. I think any sort of dictating or that sort of a stance put in place when trying to get the best outcome for a client will always result in a flawed solution. So if the creative is wrong, if the creative is not right, it's as much the media agency's responsibility as it is an editor or someone within a media organisation to say, hey, this isn't right. Because in my view, at least, the role of the media agency is to ensure that the right creative is going to connect with the right consumer. And I think that's the elephant in the room at a broader industry level. But I agree. And it's also about not being paranoid about someone else having a direct relationship or a direct conversation. I think there's no harm. There's only good things to get from that sort of openness.
Mark, how do you feel about pitch doctors?
Oh, look, I don't think there's a one size fits all type of methodology for this. I think they have an absolute role to play. I think Darren's point. I totally agree with Darren's point that that's the relationship's the important bit, and that's a very hard thing to develop in a pitch process. So it's always an abstract kind of false scenario when you're in a pitch process. And in like any relationship, you're always kind of trying to impress and put on the right spin. I think the agency selection process should really be about an agency's previous record. So you should be looking at what the agency has produced, and then it's about the relationship. So again, I don't think it's about necessarily choosing an agency on the idea or the campaign or whatever, although that is a really critical piece. But if the agency hasn't been producing great work, then it's unlikely that you're going to make any difference to that. So I think it should be. I don't necessarily always agree that a pitch is a necessary thing to do. So as far as Telstra's concerned, we do have a procurement process. And I don't know what that's been like in the past, but certainly since I've been there, they haven't interfered with the marketing department's ability or decision-making rights. So they come along pretty much as a chaperone, and they're there really much, I think, more formally for kind of legal stuff and all that other weird shit that procurement deal with. I don't even know what they do, frankly, but they certainly don't impact on our ability to kind of make decisions around what agencies we deal with. Just coming back to the very contentious issue that Henry just raised about media agencies having a say in the creative, that's quite thought-provoking statement. Because I think that media agencies are really boring and that they always come back with the same solutions. And I think the creative people should be designing the media plans. So I think there's a I think there's an argument for that as well.
Any thoughts on that at all, Henry?
Mark, maybe you've got the wrong media agency.
Tim. Look, it's interesting because this is one of the big issues for marketers is, you know, does media come first or creative come first? And, you know, everyone talks, you mentioned integration, Deborah, and the fact is that what everyone talks about but very few people do well is actually collaboration. You end up with all of these people basically working for you and no one has worked out what's the best way of getting the best from everyone. You know, we get this control system where people feel that they have to control everyone, and in controlling everyone, they actually only get from each person what they want from them, rather than what the best potential is from all of those people. I mean, sometimes great creative ideas come from media agencies, and sometimes great media ideas come from creative agencies or the media themselves. Or, you know, ideas come from everywhere, but this control system and this need to have, you know, people only do and think about what they're allowed to think about and not allow people to have this open communication is what actually stops us from achieving our maximum potential.
Lots more questions to get through, so we'll get back to those. Next question, Tiffany Frecklington.
Thank you. My question is, what do we need to do to prepare ourselves for 2011? What's the next big thing on the horizon that you see?
Maybe start with Mark this time.
I'm not quite sure what what we need to do to prepare for 2011. I think stay open and kind of flexible, I suppose. You know, I think the landscape's changing really quickly. Technology's changing at an incredible rate, and you know, consumers. The ability for consumers to kind of influence what's happening is just becoming much more profound, and I think that will continue. So I think the thing that I for me personally, I think that the thing we need to be preparing for is to kind of continue to hand over the ability for consumers to shape what a company's doing. You know, I think the web and online is legitimately a paradigm shift in humankind. I really do think, and you know, in the old days, we used to talk about paradigm shifts. In every meeting I was at, oh, this is a paradigm shift. You know, it's like changing the color of a box was like a paradigm shift for a client. It was like, I don't think so. But I think the internet is really, a seismic shift in how the planet communicates. You know, we talk about Facebook and the size of Facebook and the ability for it, and it's word of mouth, you know. People influence each other much more than advertisers can influence people. And so my ambition is to get our customers and the people that we touch talking about us positively. It's a really simple kind of challenge. The how you do that isn't so easy, but I think that's the challenge for us. And I think that, you know, consumers are incredibly savvy. I think there's an anti-consumerist kind of movement in the planet. And I think that these are some big challenges facing us in the coming years. But, yeah, I think so the ability to stay nimble and kind of flexible and open to what's going on would be critical.
Henry, what are you seeing on the horizon?
I think Mark's hit the nail on the head. Flexibility in a market that is in the perfect storm when you think of change. There is change happening at a consumer level, the net, social media. And social media is not just virtual, it's physical. And I think a lot of people, you know, forget that there's more social media taking place on a physical and on a normal basis. And that word of mouth is taking place. there aren't enough brands and marketers who are really embracing that dynamic and actually making it the backbone to what their brand stands for. Because a brand is only what the consumers of that brand are. And it sort of resonates off that. So the thought that there are brands who are scared of social media or who are worried about what people are thinking is a little bit ironic, because traditional word of mouth that was the beginning of advertising and marketing has always been positive or negative. Nothing's changed. So I think those brands that actually take that leap, and though they will be criticised, they will be spoken or referred to negatively, but that's life. And I think brands that sort of have a sort of grown up and brave perspective on that, and who also are in the conversation at the right time, will endear themselves to consumers and the broader population, even when they mess up. And I think, you know, I think people realise people make mistakes, brands do the wrong things, but humans have the ability to forgive. And I think that when you forgive, that's a moment of strength.
Darren, I'll go to Darren next. Same question to you.
Look, I agree about flexibility, but I think it's time for people to move away from price and really put the focus back on value. And that's at all levels. That's whether it's an agency, how do they bring value to their clients? How does the media bring value to your clients? How does it bring value to your readers or your viewers or whatever medium it is? I think there's been so much focus on price, and yet people have lost sight that, you know, you look at all of the technological innovations, the biggest uptake is when the user finds utility. You know, they actually find it useful and it adds value to their lives. It's intangible value. But it's looking for the ways in every interaction that we can bring value to the other party, because ultimately that's what people are looking for. You know, the argument whether you have paywalls or not. Paywalls will work if people see value in the content that's being provided. They won't work if they've got an alternative that still delivers what they want. So the whole equation here is not about whether there should be a price, it's about whether there is value. And you can apply that to every interaction you deal with on a day-to-day basis. The trouble is we've become so focused about what we pay and not about what we get for that. And I think that's for 2011 is the big opportunity to look for those every single opportunity to add value.
And Deborah, sorry for trampling on you just there.
That's all right. No, I think everything that's been said is right, but it's a really exciting year, I think, ahead. And we're talking about brands, and I think one of the things that we need to really look at is the power of the brand. And I think that will be critical in 2011 and how that brand talks 24/7 to their consumers. And by saying that, I'm not just talking about media brands. I'm talking about whether you're Sheridan or anybody else. People want to have conversations with their brands. They want to be involved in the innovation. They're looking at value for money. They'll either buy the number one brand or the home brand. There's sort of nothing in between. Unless you've got your brand right and the way that you communicate your brand, you are going to be absolutely stuffed in 2011. And by that, I mean it could be anything, by putting it on the mobile, by innovative ways of talking to them on Facebook, innovative places where you can buy your brand. I mean, you've got perfume dispensers now by Coty in the Paris Metro. I mean, there's all different ways that people can interact with your brand. If your service is part of your brand, if you're Harvey Norman, then you maybe want to be like some of the American companies who are tweeting and being available to answer queries about the new camera or whatever on Christmas Day. I mean, brands need to really look at who they are, who they're talking to, how they talk to those people, what platforms they use to talk to them, how they can be innovative, how they can make the message really simple, pull all the copy off, have a really simple, clear message. Because when you think about it, the main thing, we're all human beings. Everybody who consumes everything, we're human beings. And the problem that we have in society at the moment is we are choice fatigued. We are so open to so many things. Think about yourself. You've got everything coming at you every which way. Simplify things and find a way of being able to communicate simply with your customers, because people want some kind of editing of all of the offerings, and brands and the power of your brand is a great way to edit the choice so that you stand out at number one and you're going to be able to reap the benefits of that.
Okay, we've touched a couple of times on branded content, including talking about chop till you drop, which is a good chance to bring in a question from Miguel Gonzalez of my colleague Miguel Gonzalez of Encore magazine.
Thank you. Last month at the SPA Fringe Conference, which is a conference that the Producers Association of Australia organises for emerging producers, there was a debate about the right path that producers and content makers should take to get branded content commissioned. Some people were saying go directly to the client, others were saying go to the advertising agency, others were saying go to the media agency. So there was a bit of confusion there. So in your experience, what's the best path a producer should follow in order to pitch branded content to a brand?
I think start with Henry this time.
That's a good question. I think branded content has it's a buzzword. A lot of people think it's a really exciting and sexy part of the industry. It's definitely exciting, but it doesn't excuse branded content from needing insight. So everything has to start with an insight. And without insight, being able to marry a brand with a certain type of content is really just another shoot. So I think the key point in terms of the gateway that a producer needs to look at or work through is by understanding where that brand develops and mines insights, which it then turns into an idea or exploits into a campaign. We've done quite a lot of work in this space for clients like Unilever, for clients like Coles, Microsoft, and the reason why we still have a business in that space is because we've started with an insight, and that insight has helped shape and direct what type of content we think is viable, and it makes it much, much easier to then go to a media company and explain why this content is relevant and why that content will have demand. So I hope I've answered that. That's probably the best way I think producers could focus.
Mark?
Yeah, it's a slightly different answer to Henry, but I think that I don't know if there is a particular channel that content producers should necessarily mine over another. I mean, if it were me, I'd be exploring all of those channels as opportunities, and whether content is insight driven or not, that's a debate in itself. But I think it's about having content that's engaging. So I think what happens is that people catch on to these kind of buzzwords and these trends and think that just by doing that or saying that we've got content, that's the answer. I think, and as with all things, it's about the quality and you know, the level of engagement that content or those ideas create. So, you know, in my experience, in every area of endeavour, I'd say about 99% is crap, and I think that's being generous. I think it's the 1% of stuff that ends up exciting people, getting people talking, engages, you know, becomes something of real value. You know, to Deborah's point about the amount of information people are getting, you know, I think that the current stats are something like 6,000 messages per day the average consumer gets, and of that they remember 7%, and of that only 3% of any value to them, and then of that it's a very steep declining return. So if you say that there's 6,000 messages a day and people are only interested in 10, then you've got to be really, really good at whatever it is that you're doing.
Deborah?
I agree, and I think, you know, Henry mentioned Coles, and I have to say Coles have done this brilliantly across so many different ways. But I think that, look, it just comes back to also understanding your customer and why they want that information, what they're looking for, and where they go to find it. Now, for example, and I'll use a lot of food companies have websites, and you may be a tuna brand, and you're going to have a whole lot of recipes about tuna on your website, and you're really, really thrilled. You've spent a huge amount of money creating all these recipes. Nobody knows about it, and the reality is that they're probably not going to access the tuna website to find the tuna recipes. They're going to go somewhere like a Gourmet Traveller website, or they're going to go to other places to get what they want. When it comes back to, and I'm going to come back again to traditional media and this idea of where do we put all of this content and so on, the reality is that it will be the traditional media that drives people to find it. And I'm going to use Coca-Cola as a case in point. I think it might have been Diet Coke. They had a website set up where they encouraged young people to make short films. Brilliant idea. Now, no one would have known where to really find those. No one goes on the web really going, Diet Coke short films, unless somebody's telling them about it. And they use the traditional media, being television advertising, to drive people to the website to have a look at that interesting content, because nobody just wants to go and find out necessarily more about your product unless you're going to buy a fridge or something. But, you know, if you're going to make a movie about a shampoo, who cares? But a lot of the companies are investing all this money into doing all this stuff because they feel they have to. But it comes back to where do consumers go to find this information? And if you are going to put it in a as yet more obscure place, then you need to use traditional media to make sure people know about it. The number of times I've talked to marketers, and they may be in the shampoo business, and they've told me about their website, and I've gone to have a look at it, and it's a brilliant website. Well, no one's going to know about it. They don't even put, well, they changed it now. They didn't even put the website address on their ads. They didn't put them on the bottles. So they're creating all this content that's sitting there, hanging there in cyberspace that nobody wants to access. It may be engaging. So it comes back to, you have to have the insights of where your consumers go looking for information. You need to know how you're going to attract people to that information, whether you're going to have to push them somewhere else via another media, or whether they're already in, like Coles are in that space for whatever reason on a television show that they've done with Channel 9. These are all the kind of questions that you have to ask. Otherwise, you're just wasting a whole lot of money creating content that, you know, 10 people are going to look at. And how often do we see that?
Darren.
So there's two scenarios. One is you have a branded content idea and you hawk it around town to every man and his dog that's willing to listen to you until you finally find someone that happens to have a need for your particular product at that time, maybe. And then they come on board and they say they'll fund it and they'll turn it into a 30-second, 60-second ad. Because they're funding it, they want their product all over it, they want their brand all over it. And so it largely becomes an ad, and as we know, it's very hard to engage people with an advertising message alone. The other is to actually create a piece of content and actually run it and get following, like MasterChef. I'm sure when Channel 10 went hawking MasterChef around in season one, they got people that went, yeah, we make food, this is a food program, we'll advertise, but they weren't really into it. They get the success, and suddenly people are coming in droves wanting to be part of that success, and they'll pay a premium for doing it, and they don't get to say exactly how they get it. Because the thing is about content, and to Mark's point, you know, 99% of it is crap. And the 1%, when you go out there and prove it, then you can start actually charging for it. Otherwise, you're at the hands of the man with the gold makes the rules.
I'm aware that we're probably into our last few minutes. I'll try and squeeze in a couple of quick-fire questions. Martin Lane.
Hi, I'm Martin from TNT Magazine. My question is, has the panel seen any good ads lately?
Let's start with Deborah this time.
Let me think. I'm just trying to think. Well, I thought the chop till you drop was really clever, I have to say. So that was one. I think that, you know, clever ads, it's not so much clever, but I think it really works, is the Coles with, what's his name?
Curtis.
Yeah, not only is he good looking, but, you know, the concept is pretty good, although they've had a bit of criticism of late. The ones that I find really interesting now, I'm a little bit hooked on my tablet, which I have to call it now, as opposed to iPad, and I was really curious to see the advertising that was going to go to that new delivery mode. So I bought Wired magazine, the first application of Wired, because I thought I'd be really curious to see what they did and how they handled the first, because if anybody's going to be on the market, it'll be that magazine. And I have to say that the advertising was so much more interesting than the editorial content. The ads and the ads that they're able to create for the tablets were amazing. I could sort of press buttons and different pictures would come up, different copy would come up. I could get footage of movies that I was interested in seeing, a trailer. The ads were so interactive, and here I was thinking, oh, ads are going to be dead by the time they make the digital format. It was just a whole rethinking of advertising, and If anybody has the time to go to a magazine like Wired and have a look at the advertising and where advertising is going with a digital platform in mind, it is totally fascinating. And I think some of the ads that I've seen there, they were car ads and movies and so on, is really interesting. So maybe I'm a little bit jaded about print at the moment, but you've got to be clever to get through.
Darren, seen any good ads?
On the basis of what came to mind, first of all, it's ANZ Barbara, because I think what's happened with banks recently, all of them have just reinforced that they are Barbara.
Henry?
I can't think of an ad that has stood out, and I think largely because I'm a massive time shifter, and I'm embracing technology, and most of the ad time that I have is either in front of the television or with my iPad, and I actually fast forward ads. So a rethink is needed for me.
Mark?
I haven't really seen anything recently. I think to Deborah's point, I've done the same thing with Wired. I've got that on my iPad, and I think that what they've done with the advertising sections in that space is really, really interesting. And it's probably a bit of a cliche and a bit overly expected, but I think the old Spice work that's been running in the last 6 months has been pretty good.
And what of Telstra's output are you proud of recently?
Telstra's? None in particular. I think we've got a long way to go as an advertiser. So I'm treating it as business as usual for the time being, but I'm going to make it the best client in the country. So that's my ambition.
I think there was one ad that was really good. It was a print ad, and I think it's from New South Wales Road Traffic, and it's a teenager lying on the ground on an asphalt road, and he's obviously been hit and he's dead from the car, and around him making the drawing that they normally have around a dead body is the wire from his iPod, which is still plugged into his ears, and it's basically talking about the fact that people are crossing the road with their iPad plugged into their ears, and I thought that was actually, when I think about that, that was a brilliant image. So simple, but so right.
Well, on that advice to walk back to your office safely, I think we have to leave it, unfortunately. My apologies if you sent in a question which we didn't get to. We probably, as we only ever seem to, got through about half of them. Thank you very much for coming along and supporting it. Thank you to S2M for sponsoring, and thank you to our panel. Have a good day. Thanks.
Well, that was Mumbrella's Sydney Question Time, and this was the Mumbrella Cast. See you next time.